So if we're thinking about dependent origination, we can take that, start at the many different places that we can start out and many different ways we can start to think about it. Essentially, the idea is that is to think about the notion of origination, where things come from, as being an important or somehow it always seems to be an innate drive in our minds. We want to understand to understand something. We understand where it's come from. That's something that helps us to understand what things are or why they are the way they are. We understand where did I come from. It's that search for origins. This is something almost sort of intuitive or inherent in the nature of our knowledge that we seem to come to understanding through that way. And so, of course, this is right all through cultures everywhere, that they always have stories of origins and mythologies of origins. How did this come to be here? For example, in the different Australian indigenous peoples, different areas, they'll explain that this mountain came to be here for such and such a reason, or the blue tongue lizard got its blue tongue from such and such a way, and then they'll tell a story that explains the origins of all these things. So this is kind of almost, it seems to be universal, and need to understand things in terms of how they originated. And when the Buddha gave his teaching, he adopted this, and whereas most religions are founded on or at least include a myth of origins as an important part of their doctrinal teachings. Of course, for Buddhism, the myth of origins really is the life story of the Buddha, as opposed to a myth of origins of the universe as such. But still, there seems to be some need to explain what's the beginning of things, where do things come from? And so we know that even in the present time, and see how powerful this need is, that even in the religious communities, the insistence on the literal truth of the book of Genesis and so on, in the Abrahamic religions, and on the other side is the quest from the scientists to find an alternative explanation of beginnings of things, Big Bang and so on. Of course, the Buddha undercut both of those attempts, and he said, well, the first beginning of things is inherently unknowable. So the search for the first beginning of things is never going to be satisfied. And that's basic. That's an epistemological proposition. It's not an ontological one. It's not saying that the world either does or does not have a first beginning of samsara. What it says is that it's unknowable. And of course, the reason why it's unknowable is because if the world had a first beginning, then consciousness was not... didn't exist before that, so it's not possible to know what happened before that point. All you can see is as far as that point itself, you can't see beyond it. So you can't say whether there's anything beyond that point. So the Buddha didn't get into this idea of having sort of myths or stories about the ultimate origins of the world. There are a few stories, myths of origins in the Buddhist texts, which have a relatively minor role in Buddhist thought, but in any case those stories don't deal with the first beginnings of things. They only deal with how things moved on from a certain point in samsara, not how they actually started originally. So the Buddha said, you know, the first origin of things is unknowable. So what we deal with in Buddhism, instead of trying to know a first origin of things, we look at the notion of how our present experience actually operates. So we see, for example, often in Buddhism we take the first example that's taken is the eye. Visual consciousness is like the paradigm for other forms of awareness. And so in visual consciousness you have a fairly distinct separation of the eye as an internal object, the sights or things you see externally. And so they're fairly locatable, fairly sort of readily, we can come to grips with them, at least on a basic level. We know what an eye is, we know what, we look at a wall or something, we know what that is. And then dependence on that arises eye consciousness. the coming together of the three is called contact. So our actual experience is an embedded experience or embodied experience where all of these things, the physical dimension, the mental dimension, the consciousness, the processing of that visual information, all of that happens together at the same time in our experience. It's a meld, a complex meld of all different kinds of things going on at the same time. That's what our experience actually is. And so for the purpose of analysis and understanding, we can then separate out from that and analyze that and define it. But the actual experience is as it is. When we're talking about the origins of things in Buddhism, the origins of things are always inferred from our present experience. So this is the basis of Buddhist epistemology, that you have a certain experientially derived knowledge. It's called pachaka, it's a technical term in the later philosophy, or the suttas they call it dhammajnana, it's the knowledge of the actual given or present experience. And then the anvayajnana, or the anumana, is the inference from that. So the role of inference can take us back to the past and can take us into the future. So this is important to note. This is a very important point. It's a point which is made quite explicitly in the Buddhist texts, especially in the Jnanavattuni suttas in the Sanyutta Nikaya, that there are these two kinds of knowledge involved: the direct knowledge of experiential knowledge of what is present before us in awareness, and the inferential knowledge which derives understanding of the past and the future based on our experience of the present. And so it's very important to notice this, because there's a lot of teachers in modern Buddhism who basically deny that second kind of knowledge and say that all knowledge is based on direct experience of the present moment. And that's the only kind of knowledge which is valid. That's certainly not what the suttas teach, and nor is it what's taught in, as far as I'm aware, in any of the mainstream Buddhist traditions in ancient India. They all acknowledge these two kinds of valid means of ways of coming to know things. That approach to knowledge is comparable to what's known in Western philosophy as empiricism. And so empiricism is basically using data and then drawing inferences based on that data, as opposed to a more philosophical or rationalist approach, which is trying to argue from first principles, from first assumptions. When Buddhism talks about dependent origination and the origination of things, it's talking about understanding the nature of our present experience and then inferring from that back towards the past in one direction, and also inferring on that towards the future in another direction. So if we look at the 12 factors of dependent origination, before we go on to that, I should just say that this teaching on conditionality is embedded absolutely fundamentally throughout every aspect of the Buddha's teachings. It's completely inherent in everything, every sutta, every doctrinal teaching, every advice on practice. Everything assumes this teaching on dependence and interdependence of things. And so the Buddha completely dismissed any notion, for example, a notion that of a created God. It makes the holy life impossible if you believe the world's created by God. If you believe that the world is entirely determined by what is done in the past, it's a deterministic philosophy, then holy life's impossible. If the world's arisen purely by chance, then this makes the holy life impossible. So all of these things are contradictory to the notion of dependent origination. And they're contradictory to the notion of what we actually observe. We don't observe a created God making things. We don't observe things operating in a completely predictable and deterministic manner. We don't observe things operating completely by chance. None of these philosophies, these are all theories which are imposed on experience, but none of them are actually derivable from experience as such. So our notion, our actual experience, things have a certain regularity. There are certain patterns that we can observe, and we can make inferences and formulate principles which are based on those patterns. The British philosopher David Hume made a very important criticism of the notion of causality. And when I read about this, after I'd become a monk and I read this particular philosophical critique, I had this kind of like cold shiver down my spine. I thought, oh, that he's just disproven dependent origination. His critique was that the notion of cause is a metaphysical concept which is essentially derived from sort of a Christian notion of the divine creator, the unmoved mover, the prime mover of things. And a cause can never be actually observed. So what you can observe is phenomena and patterns of phenomena, but you can't observe a causal link between those phenomena. The causal link is just an assumed entity which underlies them. And when I read this, I thought, well, it's true. You can never actually see the cause, things causing things. You can see certain things and certain other things, but the actual cause is an inference you make in your mind. And so I was thinking, well, that therefore this proves a Buddhist notion of causality. And then I looked more closely at how the Buddha framed his teachings on causality. And in the basic thing, doctrinal formulation of causality is called idapachayata. They usually translate as specific conditionality. Imasmin sati idam hoti imasupada idam upajati. Imasmin asati idam nahoti imasa nirodha idam nirujati. With the due to the arising of this arises. With this being that is, due to the arising of this, that arises. This not being, that is not. With the cessation of this, that ceases. So this, but when I looked at that phrase, I said there was actually no notion, there's no underlying or metaphysical notion of cause in that formulation. It's simply saying when there is this, then this arises. Yeah? The arising of this, that arises. So it's an observation of patterns of phenomena. This is very, very important to notice in Buddhism. What you're observing is patterns of the arising of phenomena, patterns of the ceasing of phenomena. The cause is inferred. Right? We don't actually see the cause as such, and I think this is one of the directions, the mistakes that the Abhidhamma went on, is to try to reify this notion of cause by assembling lists of different kinds of causes and pachayas and so on and so forth, as if they're actual things. But when we look at how the Buddha talked about causality, he wasn't talking about causes as actual existing things or properties. But what he pointed to was the observable phenomena, and what we can observe is simply the patterns between things. So often they say in philosophy, they often say that causality is not correlation. Okay, correlation is not causality, and one of the classic examples of that is that in Germany, the stork population declined at the same time as the birth rate declined. Okay. So, but this doesn't prove that there's any causal relationship between storks and having children. But in fact, from a Buddhist point of view, that's actually, correlation is precisely causality. And as soon as you assume that correlation is something which is different from causality in principle, then you have to fall back on this, again, a metaphysical notion of cause. So this is a bit of a controversial idea here, but what I would suggest is that in Buddhism, the idea of causality is precisely the idea of correlation of things, and in a philosophical sense, the difference is, of course, that there's a genuine or invariable correlation between the things, whereas in this case of storks and population, there isn't, that's one criteria, and the other criteria is the effectiveness or the usefulness of the correlation. So in Buddhism, what we're talking about is we're looking at, so when I say the effectiveness or usefulness, I mean how does it actually accomplish a goal which is meaningful to oneself. So from a Buddhist point of view. From a medical point of view, for example, you want to say, well, what's the cause of lung cancer? And you want to determine whether that's associated, say, with smoking or something like that. Whereas from a Buddhist point of view, you want to know what's the arising of suffering, and you want to determine what's the cause of suffering. So in Buddhism, the notion of causality is the notion of necessary conditionality, not of sufficient conditionality. So necessary conditionality means if that particular condition is absent, then the consequence of that can never occur. Okay, imasmin asati idam na hoti. Rather than the condition of sufficiency, which is to say, if one thing is there, then the other thing must always come. And sufficient conditions are not essential or as commonly found in Buddhism. There might be some things where there's sufficient conditions, but usually it's a necessary condition, which is why they can be formulated in different ways, in different times, in different places. Because there can be many necessary conditions for the arising of any given phenomenon. So when we look at our present experience, coming back to this notion of present experience and just taking that basic example, the eye, our forms, eye consciousness and so on, and then inferring to the past and then inferring to the future, that needs to be done on the basis of inference can only happen when there's an underlying assumption that the past and the future worked in pretty much the same way that the present does. Okay, so this again is how our science works on things. For example, in evolution, you know, you understand that the principles of evolution were operating more or less in the same way in the past as they are today. So we can infer from one to the other. They change in their details. They might change in certain ways. But in any case, how they change is understood in what they've become. As again opposed to the metaphysical notion of cause of a creator God or something like that, where the act of creation by God is qualitatively completely different from anything that we can observe in the present moment. So from a Buddhist point of view, we infer back to the past and we infer to the future. And we can see that in doing so, then that teaches us a number of things. So one thing, for example, it teaches us is that just as I see things now, okay, due to these conditioned processes, I saw things yesterday. Okay, of course I saw different things yesterday, but the process of seeing was much the same. And in both of those cases, both today and yesterday, when I see things, I see them. Okay, there's a sense of a centre of identity, which kind of sits in the middle of the visual field and which is what the visual field is referring to or reporting to. So that within that visual field, there's a connection of identity. So this is one of the purposes that dependent origination has, is to be able to understand how we build up our notion of identity, of self, of who we are. And we do that by seeing our present experience and understanding there are patterns of similarity that connect our present experience with the past and the future. And it's by assuming a stable identity that's experienced those patterns, this is how one of the ways the idea of self comes about. And so then we investigate that and inquire about that according to the principles of the Dhamma, and then we realise it's actually just a conditioned process. There's no need to infer from that that there is a permanent self or a stable self through that. It's just a process which goes on in the past and which will go on in the future according to the patterns of conditionality. So this is one of the purposes or one of the things that we can use dependent origination for. So one of the ways it useful is to break down a notion of an eternal self. So it refutes the notion of eternalism, sasatavada. But dependent origination also refutes the notion of uccedavada, the notion of annihilationism, that there's only this lifetime and that after this lifetime everything comes to an end. And if you look at the way that dependent origination is explained in various commentaries and so on, and I think there's some interesting points there, is how different aspects of the 12 links of dependent origination are meant to refute these different kinds of beliefs and assumptions we make about the world in different ways. And so this teaching on the annihilationism is essentially disproved by showing that just as causes have, if we look at the fact that an effect now must have a cause before, yeah, then this kind of refutes the notion of eternalism, because it refutes the notion of a first cause. So we can say, well, whatever we experience now was caused by a past experience, or conditioned by a past experience, and then that past experience must have been conditioned by a previous experience, and so on and so forth. And we can't see any way to stop that process and just insert a first cause in that whole process. But similarly, just as we can see that the conditions in the past had an effective power, and they, not an effective power, but the conditions in the past have led to the conditions as they are now. The conditions as they are now will also lead to further conditions in the future. So just as we can't trace things back to a definitive final point in the past, we also can't trace things to a definitive final point in the future. This is a bit like I can't remember which law of thermodynamics it is, but basically that energy is neither created nor destroyed. And so psychic energy and mental energy is one of those things also, it's neither created nor destroyed. It's basically that you can't, things just don't disappear in that kind of sense. So in this way, it argues against the notion of annihilationism, just as it argues against the notion of eternalism. So one of the things when it comes to understanding dependent origination, I've been talking about it so far on a fairly abstract level. I haven't been talking about the actual links of 12 factors, and I won't do that in this talk. I won't have time to go into those in detail. But when we look at it, we're basically given this fairly incomprehensible list of dhammas which are connected by what in some cases appear to be fairly arbitrary connections. In some cases the connections are straightforward, in other cases they seem to be arbitrary. In many cases, in fact, they can be changed and are presented in different ways in the suttas. But you have one standard, most commonly presented set of 12 factors, which is what people usually mean when they refer to dependent origination. The reason, there are I think various reasons why that list appears to be somewhat arbitrary from our point of view, and I think one reason is that of course it was influenced by various kinds of formulations and ideas which were present in the time, and it's been shown fairly recently that there's a close connection between the factors of dependent origination and some of the Vedic creation myths. And so it's like a kind of a reformed or psychological or philosophical expression of some of the ideas found earlier on in the mythology of the Vedas. So this is kind of one reason which can explain why certain things are presented in certain kinds of ways. So just as an example of that is that in the dependent origination starts with avidya, as ignorance. And of course in almost every creation myth it starts with the darkness. It starts with the formless waters and the chaos that reigns. And so this is like it's a way of expressing the idea of ignorance, of course, called the dark mass of ignorance, is the phrase used in the suttas. So the Buddha talked about it in terms of a psychological ignorance, a lack of knowledge, lack of understanding. And in the myths, it was talked about as a kind of mass of darkness covering the world. So there certainly are similarities, and so this is why when we see it presented as a purely, and we take it as a purely psychological or philosophical doctrine, we're sometimes a bit bemused as to why it actually works in the way that it does. In other cases, but by saying that I'm not meaning it's just pointing out some of the influences on the way it's formed. I don't mean to say that the way that the terms are presented are in fact simply arbitrary and don't have meaning, because I believe on the contrary that they are highly structured and embed a tremendous amount of meaning, and I don't think that meaning is arbitrary. So that's to say, when we're looking for patterns and subtleties of understanding independent origination, even though in some cases we have to go beyond what's explicitly presented in the suttas to draw some certain conclusions out, I don't think in many cases, I don't think that that's arbitrary, that those things are actually intended or embodied within that pattern. It's not just reading faces in the clouds. And the teaching of dependent origination is in fact very subtle, and many of those subtleties can be observed when you look at how the factors are defined in detail, and in particular how they're used in context in different variations in different places in the suttas, and so you get an idea of the subtleties involved. The essential way, to summarise, the essential way that dependent origination works and the way to consider it is best off to start your understanding of it in the middle, the process of sense consciousness, six senses, and then conditioning, feeling, contact, and so on, and a response to that through craving. Now, that part of it is the most straightforward, and it's a psychological process which we can all observe straightforwardly right here in the present moment. And it's through a process of deepening our practice that we can then begin to infer from that to the past and the future, and to be able to understand in a more profound way how this present moment awareness entwines us and embodies us within that whole cycle of samsara, which is ultimately what dependent origination is about. And when Ananda very famously came to the Buddha and said how dependent origination was very easy for him to understand, and the Buddha admonished him. When this passage is quoted or referred to, often it's just said that the Buddha admonished Ananda for not understanding the profundity of dependent origination. But what people often overlook is the fact that when the Buddha then went on to say, well, what is the profundity of dependent origination? He then said it's because of not seeing and understanding this dependent origination that people are bound and tied up into the round of rebirth, into samsara, and can't escape from future rebirth, and can't escape from experiencing suffering in the different planes of existence. And use these very memorable similes, like matted like a bird's nest, or like matted rushes or something like that. I always think of like matted like a Rastafarian's haircut as being the simile. This is ultimately the purpose of dependent origination. And so that knowledge of the past and future, and again, this is something which is often misunderstood or not understood properly in contemporary Buddhism because of this almost narcissism of the present moment, is that it's then said, well, how can you understand dependent origination if you don't have the psychic power to be able to observe the past and the future? Now, anybody who had an acquaintance with the suttas or with history of Buddhist epistemology, then that question would be very easily answered, that there's two quite distinct ways of understanding about, say, past and future lives and so on. One is by inference, which is how you understand it in dependent origination, and the other way is through some kind of direct psychic vision, which is, of course, the development of the divine eye. These are completely distinct kinds of epistemological means. It's exactly the same as in conventional sense that if we look at, say, for example, the question of can children recollect their past lives? And certain children may be able to remember a memory that they associate with their past lives. And they have a direct memory that appears to them, and they have a vision of the place they were, their parents, their name, the events that happened, and so on, in their past lives. But then either that person or other people can then go and check that by going to finding that place, asking the people, verifying the facts, and so on. And so that's the empirical way of doing it, through inference, or the way the child does it through their own memories. So these are the two quite distinct epistemological means. They by no means oppose each other, and of course, if done well, they should support and confirm each other if they're correct. So that the inferential knowledge, which you can derive through contemplation of dependent origination in experience, should complement the direct psychic knowledge which you gain through seeing things directly, through developing the divine eye. Now, the point in Buddhism again, is the point, well, what's the purpose of epistemology? The purpose of epistemology is not to convince oneself for the sake of it. Okay, so it's not just to find out about these things for the sake of learning it, but it's for the sake of letting go. And this is why these things are not always necessary or done in the same way. Not everyone will develop the psychic recollection of past lives, for example, because for some people, an insight, knowledge, interdependent origination is enough for them to be able to let go. And that's all that matters. It's actually the letting go that matters. It's not whether you actually see it with your own psychic vision or eyes or whatever. It's whether you understand it in your heart deeply enough to be able to let go of it. So if that psychic power is going to help you to do that, then that's useful. But if it's not, then it doesn't really matter as long as the act of letting go happens. So when I say that the understanding of these things comes through inference, don't mistake me to think I'm talking about a purely logical process and that it's a kind of a rational thinking about these things. On the contrary, the nature of inference itself is, I think, highly mysterious. And the way that we come to inferential understanding of anything is actually, it's one of these things which is really hidden behind the curtain, isn't it? I mean, it's as transparent to us as the workings of the software on a computer. We don't know what goes on there, we just know what the screen tells us. In the same way, we don't know how our mind gestates and digests and the knowledge or the information or the experience that we have. All we know is that there arises within us, in a moment of inspiration, a moment of insight, there arises within us an awareness of the truth, or at least what we take to be the truth. And that's what I mean by inference. I mean, there's an arising of a knowledge, an acceptance of something, and seeing something in that way. And then that, of course, then needs to be taken and then tested and verified and so on and so forth. That's not the end of the road, that's just a moment of insight, a moment of clarity. So that when we discuss it, talk about it, contemplate dependent origination in an explicit form, we're not going to reach our deep understanding of it at that time. That's just preparing our mind, pointing us in the direction. But sometime later, when our mind is peaceful, when we don't expect it, then that inferential knowledge will arise within us. It will arise like a kind of direct insight or direct intuition of the truth. And so that's how it actually appears to us. So it's just a few thoughts or reflections on the notion of dependent origination.
Sūpāti pāṇā bhāgavā.